You're listening to the cycling podcast Femina, powered by Super Sapiens, energy management for committed athletes and coaches.
Well, hello one and hello all, and welcome to the July cycling podcast Feminan. It's only just about July. I was going to say it feels like a long time since we've met, but it's still just about sneaking in there, and we have plenty to talk about. And I am joined, as always, by the wonderful Richard Moore.
Wonderful.
How are you doing, Richard?
I'm doing wonderfully.
You weren't happy with wonderful.
I suppose I should be. I'm doing wonderfully, Rose. I'm on holiday. I know you're on holiday as well. So
yes, this is like the carry-on camping version of the cycling podcast Feminan.
You're not camping, are you? It's like
no, I'm not camping. But it's like when you have like a normal. I guess it's like one of those old sitcoms where you have the normal series, and then at the end they all head off to Benidorm or something on holiday. That's kind of what this episode is. But we have
carry-on podcasting.
Carry on podcast.
It's the first. It's actually a historic occasion because it's the first episode of the cycling podcast Femina ever in the history of the cycling podcast Femina, going back to 2016, without Orla live in the program. We are going to hear from her at some length, but she's not with us in person at the moment.
No, she's also away, but also definitely not on holiday. She is still working for Eurosport at the Olympics, so she's still got a few, quite a long stint to go, actually. But we have got an amazing package from her, reliving kind of all the thrills and spills of the Olympic road race, which, I mean, that race alone gives us plenty to talk about. But we've got so much else coming up. We've got, obviously, the chat about the road race and the time trial at the Olympics. We've got the talk about the Giro Donne, and we've also got an interview that you did, Richard, with Ashley Mormon-Passio, and she's talking a little bit about, you know, post her first ever Giro, what was the Giro Rosa, which is now the Giro Donne, her first ever win in that race. So we better get on with it. And obviously, I say roll off Orla with your news roundup. I'm going to have to say roll off Richard with your news roundup.
I mean, the one really good thing about Orla not being with us is that I'm very confident I'm going to win Cryptic Criterium this lot and sneak ahead, because I think it was level pegging, wasn't it? So I could
it
sneak
was,
ahead.
I think in honour of Orla being at the Olympics, it was meant to be the kind of leading concept of values, sporting values and good sportsmanship. I decided to not do a Cryptic Criterium. You'll be unhappy to hear.
I don't think we've got quick questions and feminine answers, have we, either?
We don't. We dropped the ball a bit. Without Orla, we need to be the perfect three.
I mean, you can't fit everything in.
You can't.
Yeah, we've got tons to get through. We're going to hear from a couple of riders who you've spoken to as well, Rose.
Yes.
The members of the Skoda Cycling Academy. That's coming up later on. So, will I get on with the news? Shall I rattle through the news? You know, it's been a month dominated by, I suppose, you know, a few big races, a few big appointments for the leading riders. And it did start all that time ago in Brittany, in France, at the start of the Tour de France, with La Course, which happened on the morning of the first stage of the Tour de France, which is a bit odd to have that race held before we'd even got underway with the Tour de France. And although there'd been sort of speculation, or in fact Christian Prudhomme had more or less said that La Course would carry on, it now appears that that was the final edition of La Course. They had said that La Course would carry on with the new Tour de France Femme, which starts next year, of course, but this was the final edition, and sort of appropriate that it was held at an odd time, very early in the morning. The riders had sort of 5 a.m. alarm calls for La Course this year. It was in a far-flung corner of France, very difficult place to get to. I mean, Ashley Moulman-Passio, who we'll hear from later on, said that she'd looked at going, but it was a sort of 9-hour travel day each way to do a one-day race. And although she'd have loved to have done it, she just couldn't justify doing that with the Giro and the Olympics coming up. So although most of the big names were there, there were a few missing. On the day, it was a great race, actually, on a pretty challenging course. Demi Vollering, one of the sensations of this season was the winner, winning from a small group ahead of Cecilie Uttrup-Ludwig, which was quite a surprise to see her pop up in second there, and with Marianne Vos in third. We went from there to the Giro Donne. Is that how you're pronouncing it, Rose?
Yes. Donne. How else would you go for it?
I don't know. I'm just checking. I'm just checking.
I'm going for Giro Donne. I'm just clinging on. I'm just going for it on that, yeah. Richard. I hadn't even paused for thought of it. But
Rob Hatch can advise us on that.
Oh yeah, no doubt.
It started, as it often does, with a team time trial, and Trek Segafredo won that ahead of SD Works. It was really the only time in the week where SD Works were not absolutely supreme. They won. They dominated the race. Anna van der Breggen won stage two. Then Marianne Vos took two stage wins, and she, that took her up to 30 in total, which is a phenomenal achievement. And we were talking a lot of the Tour de France, obviously, about Mark Cavendish and his 34 stage wins. I think he himself drew attention to the fact that Vos has now won 30 stages at Giro.
She's won 30, and there's only 10 stages in the Giro,
yeah,
of course.
Yeah, yeah. It's quite an achievement by her. In the time trial, van der Breggen won that as well, so she won two stages in total. Lorena Wiebes also won two stages. Emma Norsgaard took a stage. As you mentioned, Ashley Moomin-Pasio finally took that stage win there. And then Corne Rivera won the final stage. On GC, van der Breggen, a very convincing winner indeed. She kind of had it wrapped up very early in the week, but it was an SD Works 1-2-3, Ashley Moomin second at 1:43, Demi Vollering third at 3:25. We're going to be talking a lot about the Olympic road race, aren't we? So we'll save that. We'll hear from Orla with her blow-by-blow description of what happened. And it was fantastic to listen to that, because it's a race that, as you said, Rose, we're going to be talking about for many years to come, I think. And it's nice just to relive the uncertainty. We thought we knew what was going to happen, and that's not what happened at all. But we'll hear from Orla, and then we'll talk about it ourselves. The time trial followed that, and Annemiek van Vleuten, having won silver medal in the road race, took gold medal in the Olympic time trial. That was sort of closed the circle for her after her terrible crash in Rio 5 years ago in the road race. She has her Olympic gold medal now, and that's fitting, really, for the rider who has been the number one rider over the last 4 or 5 years. Marlon Reusser was second, and van der Breggen was third. The only other bit of news I wanted to mention was that Canyon-SRAM have announced that next year they're starting a development team as part of its long-term diversity and inclusion program. It will be a stepping stone for young riders into the Women's World Tour. They're offering scholarships to 8 riders. As part of the development team, the riders will get supervised training, individual coaching and mentorship, structured racing programs, and they'll have the opportunity perhaps also to ride as stagiaires for the Canyon-SRAM World Tour team. So they're focusing the recruitment as well on Africa, Asia and South America, areas or continents where there hasn't been much representation in the Women's World Tour, or indeed the Men's World Tour. So a very welcome development there by Canyon-SRAM, and it'll be interesting to see what comes out of that.
Yeah, I think that's particularly exciting, just because, I mean, there's a lot of, we actually have quite a lot of women's teams starting up in, I know the Uno X team, the Norwegian team, is starting up a women's cycling team, and that's meant to be a development team as well. But it's kind of exciting to see that Canyon-SRAM, obviously they already have somewhere where that pathway will lead, where the development team will lead to, being the World Tour team. And I think it's exciting to see that their recruitment process is focusing on less well-represented countries in the peloton. So, I'm hoping for some really exciting things. There'll certainly be some really exciting stories there to be had.
Still guessing on fueling? Not sure what or when to eat or drink on rides that matter? Never again. Optimize your fueling strategy with real-time glucose data, actionable insights, and personalized analytics. We're here to help you achieve your performance goals. Go to supersapiens.com for more on how to track your energy levels and fuel for success.
My name is Alexis Ryan, and I race for Canyon SRAM. First started using Super Sapiens last year when they came on as a sponsor of the team. My first impressions of it were, it just reaffirmed what I kind of knew about my body when it came to energy consumption during training and before training. But then I started to experiment with it a little bit more. It was quite interesting to see, for instance, how traveling and jet lag affected my body and affected my blood sugar. So that was a pretty eye-opening experience when you travel across the world, and there's a lot of research around the gut being an important aspect of your circadian rhythm. The more I experimented with Super Sapiens, I realized that if I got onto a nutrition plan or like a food meal plan more quickly after traveling over, I reestablished my circadian rhythm more quickly. And I learned that through using Super Sapiens and the biosensor.
Well, that was Alexis Ryan there from Canyon SRAM, and she is a user of Super Sapiens. And we're very grateful to Super Sapiens, who are our title sponsor at the Cycling Podcast. They sponsor all our shows, including the Cycling Podcast Femina. Very grateful indeed to them. I know you've got your Super Sapiens devices, Rose,
that just fit
to your upper arm like this. I've been wearing mine, and I wore it at the Tour de France. And one of the really interesting things is just the effect on things other than training on your blood glucose levels. You know, I mean, I met Phil Sutherland, the founder and CEO of Super Sapiens, at the Tour, and then again after the Tour, because I briefly attended a Novo Nordisk Talent ID camp in Normandy last week. And you know, it's fascinating, and Alexis Ryan talks about it as well, the effects of travel and, you know, lack of sleep and other things on your blood glucose levels. And as a sort of overall gauge of your health, it's very, very interesting. And it was interesting wearing it at the Tour de France, where I wasn't riding my bike a lot. But, you know, it's nevertheless, as you know, living quite a stressful life.
Yeah, it is like doing the Tour de France, isn't it? Working at the Tour de France.
Harder, probably.
Absolutely. Though there is probably a few more beers and wines to be had, I should imagine.
One or two. But, you know, all in moderation.
It is the Olympic road race. This is the day where the Dutch will believe they have a date with destiny. They are the quartet that everybody is talking about here. Very un-Dutch weather, it has to be said, in Tokyo, with 33 degrees. The flags at the Fuji International Speedway, where the race finishes, are blowing a gusto. There is a good breeze out there, but it is hot. Feels like it's hotter than for the men's race yesterday. At the moment, there's a 5-rider break up the road. It's Omer Shapira of Israel, Vera Loser of Namibia, Anna Kiesenhofer of Austria, Carla Oberholzer of South Africa, and Anna Plichter of Poland. It still feels strange saying all of their nationalities instead of any trade teams, but it's very, very early in the race as yet. 103.5 kilometres to go of this 137 kilometre course. What's really nice about this race and about the road racing in general is, because this speedway is outside of Tokyo, we don't have the same restrictions when it comes to fans. So there is a limitation of up to 50% capacity, but that means that up to 11,000 people can come to the venue. It's still a long way to go in the race, but at the moment it's not as packed as it ended up being for the men's race. A lot of empty seats. I'm really hoping that that is going to change and we'll see the stands filling up later in the day. But there is at least an atmosphere. They will be cheering as the riders come in. There will be fans here for the podiums, but I'm getting massively ahead of myself. There is a big, long race to come. Excitement. Everyone is watching these screens and enjoying the action so far. Let's see how it unfolds. The race is just getting to the start of the climbing now. It is looking hot out there. Riders continually getting bottles, pouring them over heads, putting them down their backs. I'm watching it from the relatively cool shade of the stands at the speedway, watching from across the finishing straight to the large screen, which is above the pit lane. Of course, this venue's originally a Formula One track. There hasn't been a Formula One race here since 2008. It's still very hot in the stands, though. What's really interesting at this stage is the gap has got over 10 minutes. We've got Shapira there, national champion. Plichta, a former national time trial champion. Kiesenhofer, a three-time national time trial champion as well. You've got to wonder at this stage of the race whether there's a bit too much focus behind on the Dutch tactics and maybe not enough on the front of the race. 10 minutes is doable at this stage, but they're going to want to start to bring this back, really. They'll know that, but the added intrigue in an Olympic road race, of course, is there are no race radios. They're chatting to each other on the road and to the team car whenever they're dropping back for bottles or any kind of assistance. Other than that, they're relying on their own racing nous and experience out on the road. So, as I say, we're getting to the start of the climbing. Let's see if this break has given any more leeway or if they're going to try to start to bring it back. But with 58.3 kilometres to go, we have a race on our hands. The Dutch have come to life. The spark, unfortunately, was a tumble by Annemiek van Vleuten. After falling on the same stretch of road as Geraint Thomas in 2016, she's done it again. She's fallen on exactly the same patch that claimed Geraint's race yesterday. She, however, is back up, seems to be okay, from afar at least. And what is making me say that is she's been off the front. We had Demi Vollering going on the attack shortly after Annemiek van Vleuten's fall. Then Annemiek van Vleuten was leading from the front. The Dutch are bringing this race on and everyone else is responding to it. The action is hotting up, my friends. She's been off the back, she's been on the ground, and now she's out front where we see her so often. Annemiek van Vleuten with a long solo attack from the line. And as she did so, the person next to me said, yeah, but she can't get all the way to the finish by herself, can she? I looked at them and said, you haven't been watching Annemiek van Vleuten racing lately, have you? This is daring stuff. This is how Olympic golds are won. And of course, everyone looking back to Rio 5 years ago when she had that horrific fall on the descent. I've said the story before, I'll say it again. When I spoke to her a few days after she came out of hospital, she already didn't want to talk about the chances just gone. She wanted to look at the chances to come. And this is the biggest of them all. 50 kilometres to go now in a journey that has been 5 years in the making. Kiesenhofer just coming into the speedway, and I think, well, I know, I've been guilty of assuming when Annemiek van Vleuten puts the foot down that that's almost the race over. It feels like it's inevitable sometimes. It's not far, far, far from it. And this race is wide open. The gold, however, right now is Kiesenhofer's to lose. They've got 1.5 laps of this finishing circuit. On the final lap now, and there has been another attack from the Netherlands. I'm trying to see on the big screen from where I'm sitting just who it is, but this race is absolutely Anna Kiesenhofer's to lose. It's a classic example as well of everyone jumping onto Google trying to find out everything they can about the Austrian Olympic debutant. The race isn't over. They're really pushing the pace behind, but it seems just that it's too little too late. The bell is being rung now for the bunch. 3 minutes and 54 minutes it is now, I think, the gap to the front. But I mean, I'm really just trying to follow it all on the big screen, and the graphics are slightly confusing. It's always the case, isn't it, in an Olympic road race? It's much more difficult to follow than most others. But it is the final lap. Olympic gold is going to be won within the next 15 kilometres, I think. I don't even have the kilometres to go on this. Chaos. Kilometres now stand between Anna Kiesenhofer and Olympic gold. The chase has really picked up behind. It looks like. I'm just trying to read the graphics as they come up. She's got 2 minutes and 52. And we can see the bunch just closing in on Shapira and Plichta. It looks like their valiant effort for silver and bronze is going to come 2-0, which means we're going to have a furious chase for those medals. The Dutch have to get something out of this. But there are a lot of riders who'll be wanting it as well. There is no one rider, no one team who are going to be dominant right now, certainly from the look of it. They're being caught. Annemiek van Vleuten is the rider on the front, catching them. You can hear maybe the cheers along the grandstand. Annemiek van Vleuten has just overtaken them, dragging a bit of a split bedraggled bunch behind her. You can see some riders dropping off the back. Can't quite see who that is. But we have 4.3 kilometres to go. It's still Kiesenhofer's to lose, but the race is on for the medals. Metres to go, and there is absolutely no doubt now. She has been looking in agony. This has been a hard won gold medal. 41 kilometres solo in her first Olympic Games. Anna Kiesenhofer about to cross the line as Olympic champion. Well, 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 we always say to expect the unexpected and bike racing, don't we? And then when it happens, we say, well, wasn't that a surprise? Well, yes, the most surprising of outcomes, Anna Kiesenhofer, a name I will bet my house on that none of us have ever mentioned before. Now somebody's going to get in touch on Twitter, of course, and point out all the articles. In fact, I do know that Ruler did an interview with her a few years ago. So other than Ruler and Andy McGrath, none of us have been speaking about Anna Kiesenhofer. 500-1 bet to win gold in her first Olympic road race with no teammates around her and involved in the first break of the day, went solo at 41 kilometres to go, and she made it to the line first. A gold medal for Austria, second for Annemiek van Vleuten of the Netherlands, and third for Alyssa Longo Borghini, of course, of Italy. It's still, I've said this before, but it feels strange saying their nationalities rather than their trade team names. I spoke to Anna Kiesenhofer after she got her gold medal, and she still looked a little bit shell-shocked, to be honest. She said what we would expect, really, that she only had one choice, and that was to go early in the break and just hope it paid off. A lot more goes into it, of course. She is a scientist, she's a mathematician, she's calculated things, she's been monitoring her body heat, she's been trying to make sure she acclimatizes, and I know that we don't say that anymore, we say acclimating, but I say acclimatizes to the heat, and taking a very scientific approach to it. A phenomenal win for her. I also spoke to Annemiek van Vleuten, and of course by now everyone knows that she thought she had won when she crossed the line. I find it sad that she said that she felt stupid when she realised. There's absolutely nothing stupid, of course, about winning a silver medal at the Olympic Games, her first Olympic medal after the crushing disappointment of 5 years ago. Of course it's not the gold though, and that's what she had invested everything into. There have been some queries on social media and different news reports about her suggestion that there were no whiteboards on the route. We can only go with what the riders say and what they saw. And I guess if you are attacking so much in the race and you can't see what the time gaps are, it would suggest maybe that something wasn't done quite the right way, but I have no comment to make on that other than to say that this is the dynamic, I guess, when we don't have race radio and you're always having to rely on accurate communication from your team car. We understand that there was a problem with communication between the team coach at the finish line and the team car. And it plays into the whole debate about race radios and their role in cycling. It was a fantastically exciting race to watch. There is the other argument, though, that you need to know what you're racing against and who you're racing against and what the time gaps are to beat in order to be able to win a bike race. But regardless, when Annemiek spoke to me before the race, before the Nationals, actually, a few weeks ago, a special that we put out on the Cycling Podcast and the Cycling Podcast Femina, she said she really hoped almost as much as anything that the race would be exciting, that it would be a fantastic showcase for women's racing. Well, Annemiek, you didn't get your gold medal, but you got that. It was blooming marvellous to watch. The last 50 kilometres or so were just thrilling. You can maybe tell from my voice now, I'm starting to slur my words. That is nothing to do with any alcohol, of course. I am just exhausted, which sounds ridiculous to say when the riders have ridden an Olympic road race in the heat. But it's been a long all day, 13 hours on the go, now all done, and it was worth it. A beautiful, beautiful Olympic road race threw up the unexpected. The Dutch dominance did indeed affect the race as we expected it to, but not with the end result, and a fantastic bronze medal as well for Aliso Longo-Borghini. It's been 5 years in the waiting, but we finally had Tokyo 2020.
Chute, chute à l'arrière du peloton, Cycling Podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
Well, as we all know, and as Orla was saying, uncertainty in sport can be sometimes the most exciting thing about it and why we love it. But uncertainty in the real world is something that might leave you feeling stressed or anxious. So, you know, have some good news. You can navigate change, feel more relaxed and quiet your mind with the Calm app. We're partnering with Calm, the number one mental wellness app, to give you the tools that improve the way you feel. Now, Richard, you've been using the Calm app. Tell us about your experiences. What have you been up to on it?
Can you believe that, Rose? I mean, I know I must seem like an unlikely candidate because I'm naturally so calm.
So everyone can be a candidate, Richard. Everyone, even the most unlikely person.
Well, since Calm have advertised with the Cycling Podcast for a few months now, so I put the app on my phone and gave it a go. And I actually, especially when away from home, I find sleeping very difficult. You know, when you're going to bed late, having maybe eaten a bit too much, and then up quite early, and in a different bed every night, it's quite difficult. And I use Calm at night. They've got a few, you know, it's funny because we're sharing a house here on holiday with a young baby who has a kind of white noise machine at night, and it's kind of similar for me in hotel rooms. I listen to Ocean Waves.
Ooh,
I find
lovely.
Ocean Waves help me to just switch off a bit. But on Calm, they also have kind of relaxing stories. They read by various actors and people generally with very soothing voices, funnily enough. But one I particularly liked, and which I listened to way back at the Giro, was the history of the shipping forecast. Now, the shipping forecast on its own can send me to sleep. I know a lot of people do use it for that almost. But this is a story, the history of the shipping forecast, read by somebody who presented it on BBC Radio 4 for 40 years and wrote a book about it, Peter Jefferson. The shipping forecast is a peculiarly British institution. I'm not sure if listeners from elsewhere in the world will be familiar with it. If you're not, it's almost a foreign language. You know, the places, the weather patterns that it describes will not be familiar to most people. But that's kind of the point. And I find it a very relaxing thing to listen to. And Peter Jefferson's history of the shipping forecast, similarly, very, very soothing and relaxing. And really enjoyed that. And there are a few train journeys, stories of train journeys as well on there, which I also enjoy. You get the sound of the train on the tracks in the background, and that can be very useful as well. Often you miss the end of the story because you fall asleep, so you have to go back and find out what actually happened. But no, it's very, very enjoyable. I know Orla enjoys it as well, so I find it useful on the road.
Yeah, it's absolutely. If you haven't fallen asleep just listening to Richard talking about someone else talking about the shipping forecast, then you should definitely go and check out the Calm app. There's loads of stuff. There's also physical things like stretches. There's stuff for kids who might be suffering with anxiety. There's long plays of famous records, like, you know, ones by Ariana Grande and things that slowly wind down into a sleep state. So there's absolutely loads on there. So go and check it out. And for listeners of the show, Calm is offering a special limited time promotion of 40% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/cycle. Go to calm.com/cycle for 40% off unlimited access to Calm's entire library. That's calm.com/cycle. Well, that was just fantastic from Orla, hearing about a play by play, just reliving all those emotions. It's so easy to get caught up with the narrative at the end of the race, which was, you know, seeing Annemiek van Vleuten celebrate, obviously Anna Kiesenhofer winning, which was totally unpredicted. What was your kind of main takeaway, Richard, from the road race?
Well, it was great listening to Orla talk us through it, because it helped me to place myself back on my sofa watching it and feeling like I knew what the outcome would be. And there were just, you know, signs of, you know, the inevitability of Annemiek van Vleuten attacking, getting away and just eating lumps out of that lead. And you know, I was very much reminded of Strada Bianca last year, 2020, the August edition, where Mavi Garcia was away and, you know, the break had a big advantage there as well. Not quite as big as the break in the Olympic road race, but
it was boiling hot as well, which hot. Was the same as, yeah. as here.
And it looked like an upset might be on the cards there. But when Van Vleuten got away, we didn't get a lot of information on her chase, but she just suddenly appeared. You know, she just materialized in that front group, and their dreams were dashed. And I kind of expected exactly the same thing to happen in Tokyo. You know, it was a challenging course, not as challenging as the men's road race, but still pretty tough. And when Van Vleuten got away, and you know, the lead at that point was about 5.5 minutes, and I expected it to be coming down by 30 seconds with every time check sort of thing. And that wasn't happening. It was stabilizing. And then it kind of went out again. And I thought, this is surprising. What's going on? Is Van Vleuten on a really bad day? And then there was that wonderful moment where she was caught by the group behind. Kasia Nevyedova was the first to draw level with her, and she kind of did a double take, you know, as she looked across, because the script was just well and truly ripped up, wasn't it? And for a kind of an analysis of what happened and why it happened, I do recommend listening to Lizzie Banks on the regular cycling podcast. Lionel spoke to her for her take on what happened and why it happened, and it's really, really interesting. She's got lots of thoughts and theories, everything from the blackboard being a whiteboard to the difficulty of, you know, taking in information when you're making a big effort like that. The sort of fact that a lot of us don't appreciate when we're watching it on TV, that the rider's view of the race is so one-dimensional. You know, we are getting a pretty close to three-dimensional view of the race. We're getting a lot of information. The riders are not getting the same amount of information. They're not obviously seeing what's happening up the road. They can be really quite in the dark, especially without race radios, of course, which has been another big talking point. But, you know, there was this expectation that the Dutch, because they had such a strong team, would be able to close it down and bring it back. But you look at the team they had, four riders, Marianne Vos, Demi Vollering, Anna van der Breggen, Annemiek van Vleuten, all potential winners. And that I think was the problem. I mean, well, one problem is the size of the team, only four riders. But really, they brought a team for the final 50 kilometers if everything was together. You know, if everything had been together 50 k's to go, somebody from that team, I'm sure, would have won the race. What they didn't bring a team for was a scenario whereby a breakaway had over 10 minutes lead. And then who do you get to go to the front? I mean, you need more than one rider, really. You need a couple riders to at least to be riding quite hard behind. And really, they didn't really have the personnel for that, unless they wanted to completely sacrifice Anna van der Breggen and Demi Vollering at that point.
They're also so, I mean, they're so different as riders, and yet they are so similar. I mean, I think Marianne Vos is slightly different from the other three in that she's kind of your woman if you want a fast finish. If it's just going to be a kind of sprint to the line, you want Marianne Vos to be protected. But the other three, they're kind of set of, although they race very differently, You know, Anna Meek is a lot more kind of has that explosivity, whereas Anna van der Breggen has got more, is more kind of that engine. You know, when she attacks, we saw it in the Giro d'Italia as well, she just slowly pulls away from people. It's less kind of explosive. But the courses that suit them are all for Vollering, Van Vleuten and van der Breggen. It's kind of the similar courses. So you're basically asking someone to give up their chances on the day when you've got three people who are champions and could all win it. Really needed someone kind of like Ellen van Dijk, who could just motor on the front and whose job was solely just to bring any breaks back and bring back any attacks. But it's funny because I think we were talking, well, the whole script before the race was just that it would be Dutch dominance and how can you beat this quartet of riders. But it did remind me of the European Championships in 2018, which Marta Bastianelli won. And then at that race, there was like, you know, a full set of teams. So they kind of, everyone had eight riders. The Dutch, you know, roster of eight riders was absolutely phenomenal. They had Lucinda Brand in there and van der Breggen and van Vleuten. And they still couldn't win that. And I think it's partly also that slight miscommunication between them. That's what it was in that European Championships in 2018. It was again a case where there was no race radios, they didn't quite know what was going on at the break, no one was quite sure who was in the break, and no one was quite sure whether they should be chasing back or not. And in the end, they totally fluffed it up, and it meant that Marta Bastianelli won, which was totally unexpected then. So there has been a precedent before for to have this strong Dutch team and for them to not come away with the result.
I mean, there is a danger, of course, and the coverage since has been kind of 50-50. The Dutch messed it up, and Anna Kiesenhofer pulled off an incredible coup. And it shouldn't detract from her incredible performance, because you say, you know, the question for a lot of riders going into the race and a lot of teams was, how do we beat the Dutch? Well, Kiesenhofer had the perfect solution, didn't she? I mean, what a story. I mean, she attacked at kilometer zero. We kind of got to know her more as the race unfolded, not least by looking at her own social media and her tweets telling us how she was preparing for the heat and so on. I mean, I'm sure all the riders prepared really well for the conditions, and we're maybe putting too much emphasis on that as well, because she also struggles to ride in a peloton. That's a major weakness for her and a big problem for her in competing in road races. And so here was the perfect solution. It was to attack at the start, get away in a small group with two other riders, and build a huge, huge lead. And they sort of took advantage of the small teams, the small field, the fact that there were perhaps a lack of riders and teams willing to really commit to keeping their lead down, because you don't see that often in women's racing, that a break gets such a huge lead, and in the end they just gave them too much to do. And you know, when Kiesenhofer took off with 40k's to go on her own, that looked like a doomed move. It looked like the breakaway at that point was doomed, because they'd been working pretty well together. And it seemed a strange move. But again, looking back with hindsight, she knew what she was doing. And she obviously knew the effort she was capable of making over the distance. And she just rode the perfect race. You know, an unusual and unexpected Olympic champion, but definitely not an undeserving one.
No, totally not. And I think there's a lot of kind of talk about this idea that she was an amateur rider. But I think with the women's peloton, you know, it's different from the men's in that quite a lot of them are unprofessional, in that they don't get necessarily paid wage that would be enough to live on entirely from cycling alone. So I think when, you know, we kind of talk about Anna Kiesenhofer and, you know, who is she? And, you know, it's not like she's going to be turning up on Box Hill at some point doing a little, you know, local race. She is a rider who has ridden races at the top level and beaten some. She had some amazing results at the Tour of the Ardèche, which is one of the, although it's a lower class of race, it's actually one of the very hardest races that you can do. It's one of the few races in women's cycling, where it's a stage race with which is consistently climbing, has got consistently got a lot of very big climbs like the Mont Ventoux, and she actually won on Mont Ventoux a few years back. So I think people shouldn't underestimate the class of rider that she is. This isn't just some hapless chopper who's just hopped on a bike. This is someone...
Hapless chopper. Oh, brilliant.
This is someone who is a top-class athlete. And obviously, as you say, Richard, you know, if you go on her social media, you can she is a mathematician and is doing a postdoc and things. But she's really got that kind of clinical approach to training. I mean, it's not like she was just turning up at the Olympics on a jolly. She really was focused on it and training for it and preparing for it like a full-time athlete would.
Looking forward to getting my Not a Hapless Chopper t-shirt. That would be good. Again, the emphasis on her PhD in mathematics and her very scientific approach to it. Also, there's a danger there of underappreciating the athletic performance in a way. You know, the fact is that on the day, you know, when Annemiek van Vleuten was chasing behind, she wasn't making inroads into her lead. She finished the race with still quite a decent margin. I mean, she rode a fantastic race and she's clearly a brilliant athlete, and it'll be fascinating to see what she does next. She doesn't want to go into the Women's World Tour and ride all the road races, but she's, you know, one of the unfortunate things is she couldn't ride the time trial. They didn't qualify for the time trial, so we couldn't see what she could do there. Although whether she'd have recovered is another question, I guess. But that might be her focus in the future. Who knows? Just a very different rider, and you know, you get that occasionally in cycling. It's sort of a kind of a Graeme O'Bree type performance where somebody comes apparently from nowhere, does their own thing, prepares in their own way, again with that very scientific and methodical approach. And I love the fact that the script was ripped up. I think it's one of the great stories, one of the great Olympic stories, one of the great cycling stories, this win by Anna Kiesenhofer. And it's gonna be fascinating to see what she does next. And to get her on the podcast at some point, because she's clearly a very, very interesting person as well. I thought it was a nice point that Orla made about Van Vleuten saying she felt silly in celebrating, because as Orla said, why not celebrate the silver medal? Okay, she thought she'd won, and that's what she thought she was celebrating, but she shouldn't feel silly at all. If anything, that whole confusion sort of endeared her to people more. I guess the inquest is about why did the Dutch team, because some, you know, Elisa Longo-Borghini, who got a bronze medal today, she knew that Kiesenhofer was still up the road, but Lizzie Dagnan didn't.
She did celebrate her bronze medal, didn't she? She gave it kind of in a more muted way, kind of gave a little pat to her federation flag on her top. But yeah, like you were about to say, Richard, I presume, was that Lizzie Dagnan also thought that Annemiek van Vleuten won, which was when I saw it on the BBC, they didn't pick up on her saying that whatsoever, which was totally, totally baffling for me. But I mean, obviously there was a lot of confusion, and yet, you know, you see that Marianne Vos knew that Anna Kiesenhofer was ahead. So there definitely was an element. It's not that Annemiek wasn't the...
If Vos knew, she would have assumed that Van Vleuten would know, you know, so communication isn't that easy. And Van Vleuten was up the road for a bit and then back. And I mean, I think the confusion is sort of understandable on the day. Like the vision, the view that you have as a rider is very, very limited a lot of the time. But after that, I think a lot of people would have enjoyed the fact that Van Vleuten won the time trial and got her gold medal in the end, because we do all remember what happened to her in Rio and how in Rio she probably wouldn't have won the gold medal. You know, she was on her way to winning the gold medal in the road race before she crashed. So just her, you know, her status over the last few years, as along with Van der Breggen, who is, of course, was the reigning Olympic road race champion, as the preeminent female rider, it's fitting that she has an Olympic gold medal now.
Absolutely. Well, a gold and a silver to take home now. But on the time trial as well, it was amazing to have a performance by Marlen Reusser. Another, obviously, not, it wasn't for gold, but I think that was a little bit of an upset. Obviously, we know her very well as a very strong time trialist. She's also now the Swiss champion. But to see her, I mean, the cameras were, it was a bit, little bit like in the road race when there were was actually very little footage of Anna Kiesenhofer in the front. The focus of the TV cameras was all on that group of favourites who were actually not even in medal contention, at that point on the road. In the time trial, I think we hardly saw anything of Marlon Royce's performance at all, apart from when she crossed the line and then it turned out that she had taken silver. But there was that, I mean, even Anna Meek winning that time trial was, although she won it in extreme fashion, was a little bit of an upset, because I think a lot of people going into it were talking about Chloe Dygert and what she could do. I know when I was speaking to, we were recording the Bunny Hop a few weeks ago and talking to Jo Rousel about what her kind of predictions for the Olympics. And she was sure that Chloe Dygert would be, you know, winning the time trial. And then, you know, she's now got a stint on the track where she's in the team pursuit and would basically be pulling the whole American team along because she is so, so, so strong. So it was interesting to see that, you know, that bit of upset. She kind of finished in the top 10, but couldn't do any more than that. So a great result for Annemiek van Vleuten to get that goal, that she's kind of finished that story. And I know that she was pointing to the finish, was pointing to the earrings in her ears and shouting for her mum. And I know that the earrings that she wears, she likes to think they give her good luck because they were giving to her from her late father. So I thought that was a very special moment for her to finally take that Olympic gold.
The cycling podcast Femina is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much indeed to Science and Sport, our longtime sponsor. They support all the cycling podcast shows and we're very grateful to them. If you want 25% off all your Science and Sport products, bit of a test for me here, Rose, because I'm on holiday. I've had a couple of weeks off after the tour. Can I remember the discount code? Go to scienceandsport.com and enter the code SISCP25. SISCP25 for 25% off all your Science and Sport products.
Don't worry, Richard. Do you want me just to sing the little earworm so you never forget it again?
No,
and
don't
it
worry.
Won't ever leave
don't
your
worry,
head.
Rose. I think we're
I can really, I,
think
I can
good.
Help you out there. I just
I think we're
just,
good.
You know, oh. Okay.
Are we going to talk about the Giro Donne?
As it's yes, now, we definitely
as it's
should.
Known. Kind of revamped, reinvented, back in the World Tour next year, the Women's World Tour next year, where just from a timing point of view, it's going to be interesting because we've got Tour de France Femme at the end of July, the Giro at the start of July. And one of the things Ashley Momopasio spoke to me about when I spoke to her recently was about the top riders maybe having to make quite difficult decisions about, if not what to ride, then what to really focus on. And it's not ideal that those two, the two biggest, arguably the biggest stage races, although the Women's Tour would also have a claim, and it's pretty close to those other two as well in June. It's unfortunate they're all packed so tightly together in a way, but we'll see how that develops. I spoke to Ashley Momopasio before and after the Giro. I was keen in the first interview with her to speak about her team, SD Works, which she's joined this year, and very different experience for her being, one of many stars rather than a leading light, I suppose. The team is absolutely packed with the top riders, and that can be both a blessing and a curse, I suppose. So I was keen to find out how that was going. And this was before the Giro, of course, where we saw another fantastic team performance, and she ended up second overall at the Giro. But let's hear what she was saying before the Giro about how she was fitting into her new team.
Yeah, so I'm definitely part of a super team, and that is quite a different dynamic to what I've experienced before. Of course, CCC Live was a little sort of taste of what that could be like, being on a team with Marianne Vos, because, you know, she is just such an incredible cycling talent that, it's a taste of what it feels like to kind of be on a team with such a big rider like her. But in CCC's case, it was, you know, just Marianne and then me, and then, you know, a lot of sort of more Domestique style riders. Whereas on SD Works, I mean, the team is stacked with riders who can win races. And just the environment within the team, because it's such a high-performing team, it means that, you know, even, you know, the younger riders or domestique-style riders are also stepping up in every race and, you know, becoming better and better. That's exactly the kind of environment that it is. It's a very supportive and professional environment, but at the same time, it is quite a competitive environment, you know. It's quite competitive within the team itself, you know, not only in the race. And yeah, I think that's been a really good experience for me, because it is sort of putting me a little bit outside of my comfort zone. You know, Cervelo Bigler was, you know, really a more sort of a smaller team, family style team, where I was a very clear leader. Mm-hmm. And now learning to work within such a competitive environment, you know, has been an adjustment for me. I unfortunately, you know, started off a little bit slow this year. It was just some kind of training decisions that I'd made, which meant I wasn't necessarily super sharp in the first couple of races, which, you know, meant it was maybe a little bit difficult to find my feet in the team. But it was also sort of strategic around my goals for the second part of the year with the Giro and the Olympics. You know, being a South African rider, I have the luxury of not having to perform to be selected for the Olympic Games, you know, in the early part of the season. So that does give me you can look at the advantage possibly of taking things a little bit slower in the beginning part of the season and really keeping that big peak for the Olympic Games, which is a decision I chose for this season. So yeah, I mean, I had a slightly slower start to the season, and then I've had a really nice consistent performance, you know, in the middle part of the season in May. So I'm really happy with the progress I'm making personally. But yeah, it's meant that I've been somewhat more of a supportive role within the team, not necessarily prioritizing my own results. But yeah, I mean, it's a wonderful environment to be in, because it's super professional. We have access to everything of the best. So everything that you need as a rider to perform at your absolute best. And then, as I said, it's a very healthy dynamic of competition within the team as well.
And is that competition even, you know, to be selected for races? Because, you know, if I look at the whole squad, there's quite a lot of rotation goes on in terms of riders being picked for different races, and probably fewer race days than you might have on another team. Is that an element of it as well?
Yeah, of course there is also competition for race selection. We kind of have, you know, quite a clear sort of split in the team. So there's sort of the climbing team, and then the sort of sprinting slash, you know, sort of flatter style race team. But then there is some crossover as well, you know, with certain riders like Chantal Block, for example, or Elena Cecchini. They make some crossovers between those two teams. And I suppose for me, the only real like disappointment or competition that I really felt in terms of selection for races was for the Cobble Classics. You know, in the past, very early in my career, I never thought I'd ever be good at those kinds of races because of my small stature and my light weight. But, you know, with my experience with Thomas Campana on the Bigler team, you know, he really helped me to find myself in those kind of races. And that had a lot to do with tire pressure. You know, so I'm very, very sensitive to tire pressure when it comes to the cobble races. So it was the first time for a long time in my career that I was left out of the Cobble Classics. And it was a little bit of a hard pill to swallow. You know, I had very direct conversations with Danny about this. But at the end of the day, I mean, I understood exactly where he was coming from and why I wasn't included in that team. So that would be the only real race where I felt, you know, very big competition from my side in terms of being selected or being left out. Yeah. Other than that, I mean, we have the core of the climbing team is Anna, Demi, and myself. You know, so generally speaking, you know, selection is not really an issue for the races that I would like to race because I'm naturally included on them. But yeah, I mean, there is, of course, competition within the team for selection.
I detected a sort of edge, Rose, to what Ashley was saying about the competition, even for places within the team, a sense of internal competition, not rivalry, but competition, even for places. You know, she was disappointed to miss out on the Cobble Classics, where she's always ridden quite well before, even though she is very small and she is a climber, she enjoys those races. So really interesting, but I think for her to challenge herself at this point in her career as well, it reflects well on her. And you know, she's been so close to taking that big win over the last few years, and she's finally got it, you know, with that big stage, mountaintop finish at the Giro. That was a big victory for her, and a hugely significant one as well.
Yeah, I think when I heard that she was going to SD Works, I was actually really, last year, I was really, really surprised, because she really has been almost the one woman band on a lot of teams. She's been at Bigler, and she's kind of was the one and only. She was with at CCC Live, and then it was her and Marianne Vos, but they're such different riders that, you know, there was never any conflict. So I was surprised that she would go into a team that was so stacked with winners, basically, because, I mean, Ashley Mormont-Passio, she's an incredible rider, and she's always been cited as one of the favourites before any race that's kind of climbing based, but the amount of times that she actually gets the win is actually very, very few. I think there's, you know, like Kasia Niewiadoma is kind of a similar rider in that she's always one of the favourites, but actually her winning record, there aren't so many wins on it. So it's amazing to see that she's come out with this win at the Giro Donne, and I think it is almost entirely, well, obviously not taking away anything from her talent and the fact that the course perfectly suited it. It was just one big, big climb. It was that stage 9 Monte Matajur summit finish. And it was just a long climb, you know, for the women's peloton. It was a long climb. You don't get so many of those in the calendar. But also it was, thinking about the fact that she was second on GC, in any normal race, if you had someone second in GC go off up the road, there's no way that everyone would leave them to it. But because by that point in the race, SD Works had such a vice-like grip on that those podium places on the overall. They had Anna van der Breggen, and she was way ahead. No one was going to bother chasing Ashley Moorman as she went off when Anna van der Breggen was further back. And really, everyone, even by that point, was already trying to chase the lower rankings or trying to make it onto the podium as opposed to trying to go for the win. So I think there was a lot of circumstance involved in it. But it's, you know, we've spoken to Ashley Moorman a lot over the years because she's such a great speaker, such a great ambassador for the sport. She's someone who is so focused and probably doesn't get enough of the races that suits her down to the ground. So it was so nice to see her actually managing to have all of those things come together and give her opportunity to take the win.
Shall we hear what she said about that win after the Giro? I spoke to her just after she'd returned home and as she was preparing to fly out to Tokyo.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, it was an open discussion amongst, you know, the team and staff, you know, around what our personal ambitions were. And that was, you know, one of the sort of big ambitions for me is to win a stage at the Giro, because, you know, I have taken part in, well, 11, but I pulled out of the 2017 one because I was ill. So 10 complete Giros now. And, you know, I hadn't won a stage. I'd only ever finished second or third. So never a stage victory. So that, you know, I made it clear that was a goal during this year's Giro. And I mean, it could have happened on a couple of stages, but I suppose, you know, stage 9 was really the stage that I'd kind of earmarked as a stage that really suited me. So yeah, I mean, as the tour progressed, of course, I took any opportunities that I could beforehand, but always keeping in mind that, you know, stage 9 was really the one to go for it. And it was quite a long range breakaway, but I also kind of, you know, that's also something that I've been sort of working on mentally personally is to not be afraid to race to my strengths, you know, and if that means going early, then, you know, to have the courage to do so, rather than always, you know, waiting for other people to determine the tactics on the day. So, yeah, I was really proud with how that worked out, you know, solo on the Queen stage. Yeah, it was really special. Going into the Giro, I had a discussion with Carl, my husband, and, you know, he said, well, you guys can finish 1, 2, and 3. And I thought, well, okay, yeah, it's possible. But maybe let's not be too greedy or ambitious to start. But yeah, I mean, very early on, you know, from the second stage on, it was clear that it was very much possible for the Tour to finish 1, 2, and 3. Yeah, I mean, it's actually quite an interesting dynamic because, you know, and I think that's something which I'm really impressed by is that how, you know, as a team, we managed to kind of find that balance between working together and being a unit, but also there's a little bit of competition internally, you know, but healthy competition in a way that, you know, motivates us and kind of pushes us to be better than we were before. So I think that's quite unique to find that balance where, you know, when it's necessary to be a unit, we're a unit, but when we're out there and we're ahead, you know, to also challenge one another. Like, for example, on stage 2, where, you know, Anna was, I was chasing Anna and Demi was chasing me. And then similarly on stage 9. So yeah, I think it's quite a special team environment to be part of because yeah, I think Danny as director has a very good way of managing, you know, the talents that he has within the team and getting the best out of everybody. From an organizational point of view, I definitely think it's the best Giro I've ever taken part of. You know, it was very well organized. You know, usually in the Giro, we are always kind of accustomed to some kind of, you know, surprise somewhere along the way, whether it might be middle of the stage, you know, that something changes or, you know, the day before. So that's kind of, you know, it's always been a joke, you know, about the Giro that there's a surprise is inevitable. But this year, everything ran perfectly smoothly and everything went according to the book and to the route profiles. And even, you know, the accommodation, we were in really good hotels. I think it worked very well to be in the north of Italy, if I'm totally honest. You know, it just means that it's that much easier in terms of sourcing really good hotels and the food is also much easier in the north. So, yeah, I think everything went really smoothly. Of course, you know, I have heard feedback that that the exposure or the TV broadcast was not ideal or not great. And I think the real reason for that is, of course, that there wasn't reliable 4G signal everywhere. So, yeah, I mean, the reality is that the organization didn't invest in making sure that the TV broadcast was at the highest standard. So, you know, we didn't have helicopters in the sky and stuff like that. Of course, that comes at quite an expense. So, you know, you have to kind of see it in a way that progression comes in steps. And I think that this is at least, you know, a positive step in the right direction. And, you know, hopefully with the feedback that the organization received, of course, it's great that the fans are speaking out now and you know, making the shortfalls very, very vocal and obvious. So I'm hoping that next year the TV broadcast will be that much better.
Well, that was Ashley Moulman-Passy reflecting on a really successful Giro for her and her team. And it's a race that, as I said in the interview, she's had a love-hate relationship with. She wrote an essay about the Giro Rosa, as it was then, for our book, A Journey Through the Cycling Years, cycling podcast book a few years ago. She kind of wanted to love the Giro, but fell out of love with it for the fact that it was often so shambolic in its organisation and there were lots of problems with the race. It's under new organisation now and it does seem to have stepped up, but there are still problems, especially with the TV coverage, aren't there, Rose?
Yeah, there are. I mean, it is still something that's so difficult to follow. And I have to say, one of the things that I'm relieved about with the announcement of the Tour de France Femme coming in next year is that it won't be run on the same day as the Tour de France. I think partly that takes away a lot of eyeballs, for one thing. But I mean, the coverage left a lot to be desired. I mean, we had on that stage 2, Anna van der Breggen win, which was really the stage that set up the narrative for the rest of the whole Giro Rosa. We didn't even get to see the attack that Anna van der Breggen made at the time, because the coverage joined with about 10k to go, and then it ran until about 7k to go, and the whole group's still together. And then it cuts away. They obviously lose signal, cuts away until about 2 or 3K to go. And then you see Anna van der Breggen. She's already 1.5 minutes ahead of everyone else. And it's kind of, that was where the whole stage race was made. And yet we didn't actually manage to see it, which was a huge shame. And hopefully, I can only hope that with it being back on the women's tour next year, that it will be better, stronger, and the coverage will be better, because there's so many regulations around. If you want to be a world tour race, you have to have a decent live stream. But yeah, there's so many stories that I think got kind of overlooked because we just didn't have as much coverage as we'd wish. We mentioned it earlier about Voss getting 30 wins. It was interesting to see Team DSM managing to get a few wins. You know, they've relied on Lorena Wiebes to get the odd win this season, but them to actually come away with 3 wins, 2 for Lorena Wiebes and 1 very emotional victory for Corinne Rivera, who, you know, has been a little bit in the wilderness, I guess, the last few years. We haven't seen, she had so many, she won the Tour of Flanders, and she had a few great seasons where she was really the one to beat. It was great to see her finally back on the top. Obviously, it was an emotional year for her. Her dad, Wally, who is her kind of greatest inspiration, was the person who inspired her to get into cycling, and is kind of was a famous figure in the American racing scene. He would always be there to support Corinne at every race. He died this year because of COVID. He was a healthcare worker and on the front line, and so to see her, so I think it was very emotional for her to get that win. And so there's, I think, you know, it's a shame that we didn't, those stories perhaps didn't make it into the wider public consciousness as much as we would have liked, I think.
And sort of on that note, you know, one of the great things about that Olympic road race was the fact we were able to watch the whole thing. Not you know, as you say, we didn't see as much of Kiesenhofer as we would have liked. There was some odd, the way the action was showed was quite odd in a way, but the reason for that race and that story, or the stories from it resonating so powerfully and widely, is that so many of us watched it. We were able to experience it. And had we not been able to do so, and had we not kind of witnessed the unfolding of the narrative, the waiting for the Dutch to attack, the seeming inevitability of the lead coming down, then it not coming down, you know, to live through all that, it leaves it more indelibly kind of planted in your brain and in your memory bank. And
it's just the suspense of it, isn't it?
It's a great advert for just giving more coverage. If we can see more, we experience more, and it leaves a more powerful impression. Well, the Skoda Cycling Academy is something we've followed on the Cycling Podcast Femina for a few years now. Skoda have been partners of ours, and in fact, they gave us a very nice, superb car at the Tour de France. But the academy goes from strength to strength. Dame Sarah Storey is the mentor there, and recently they took in 4 new young riders. And as part of the academy, it's for under 23 riders. They're obviously supported to develop as cyclists, and Sarah Storey is on hand to give them all kinds of tips and advice about training and racing and so on. I've met some of the academy recruits in the past, but it's very interesting, this new intake of 4, because 3 of them have switched sports during the COVID pandemic, and in fact because of the COVID pandemic, and we're quite used to cyclists coming into cycling from sports like running and swimming and skiing, ski jumping, but the latest intake, one of them was a pretty good tennis player, so all that hand-eye coordination now going to waste on a bike, but I think she's still carrying on with the tennis. But Rose, you spoke to a couple of them recently.
Yes, I did. Olivia French is the former tennis player. Obviously, I guess the hand-eye coordination will be useful for grabbing a bead on in a race situation, I guess. I can't think of anything else. But yeah, so she's got a really interesting story. Also Maddie Aldam Gates, who was a swimmer, but obviously when the swimming pools all closed down during the first lockdown, she was trying to find another outlet for her athleticism and found cycling. Both of them inspired, I think, by their fathers to kind of get on their bikes and get out there. So really interesting. Two aspiring cyclists. Let's hear from them now. Maddie, you've obviously just joined the Skoda Academy. Tell us a bit about how you got into cycling in the first place.
So I used to be a swimmer until the first lockdown, and then all the pools shut down. And I just decided that I had to find something else to do to fill the massive void. Because I swam five times a week, and it was quite a lot. So I did want to replace swimming fitness wise, and also, you know, just entertainment wise, I needed something to do in that lockdown. So my dad's a cyclist. He's been really keen on it for years, and he just said, "Well, you can come out with me if you want and see if you like it." So that's what I did, and we just went from there. Really, we started off doing turbo sessions, I think, when we weren't allowed to go out for long rides. So that was sort of plunged into the deep end. We started with quite intense, hard turbo rides, which I think due to being in swimming and sort of used to the hard training discipline, it was manageable for me at that stage. So I was really grateful for swimming for that sort of base fitness and, you know, the mental ability to just put my head down and work. Yeah, I felt quite well prepared for that. And I did really enjoy doing those turbo rides initially, and then started to get out once the restrictions began to lift.
And how did you find it? Were you immediately quite nifty on the bike, or was it you started by not being so good or not enjoying it so much?
Until that point, we'd been on sort of family bike rides and things, and I'd never particularly enjoyed cycling that much, strangely, until that point. And then we started doing the hard training rides, and when I began to view it as a training sport, something that I could really train hard at, I really did start to enjoy it, and I loved the challenge. And it wasn't until the pool shut that I sort of found that in cycling. So I'm always grateful to that in a way for, you know, helping me realise I do really enjoy it.
And obviously at the Skoda Academy, you've already done a few road races. How have you found that? It must be quite a, you're kind of in at the deep end doing that straight away.
Yeah, so I did my first road race, I think, like a week or two before I officially started with the Skoda Academy. It went okay. I mean, I managed to stay with the lead out, the bunch group at the front. It wasn't a race full of many attacks, but it is just such a new thing to ride in a group of that size. So I think there were 60 riders at the start, and that was completely new to me. But I do pace line rides with my clubs. So I'm with Bath CC and Bradfnavon CC, which are local to me. And they do really good pace line training rides where you ride in a group and you do the same kind of rotation training that you might expect to find in a race. So it's really good race preparation. So I was prepared in terms of that physically, but there's no match really to setting off in a group of 60 or even 120 or 140 like at the Cycle Classic. There's no comparison to that, and it is, you know, the only way to become familiar with it and get more comfortable with it is to just do it. So it really is about jumping in at the deep end and accepting that you might not do that well, you know, at first, even maybe for the first year, but it is just about learning and familiarizing yourself with that, because it's completely different to anything that you'll have done before.
So Olivia, how did you, tell us about your journey into cycling? So I know it's not the sport that was your number one passion.
So yeah, until like the first lockdown in March 2020, I probably hadn't touched a bike in quite a few years, probably since I was like 11 or 12. I was a tennis player. They shut the court, and obviously we didn't know for how long. It was a very new situation. So my dad, he cycles a bit. He said, "Why don't you come out on a couple of rides with me?" And I had like so much time on my hands because obviously we're all just inside. So I thought, why not give it a go? And I didn't particularly like it at first because my dad was beating me up hills and I was not particularly good, but then I just got started doing more and more and then just got really, really hooked, and then cycled a lot over summer. And then as I went back into university, I joined the cycling club for the first time and went on a few group rides with everyone there, which I really, really enjoyed. And then I was still focusing mainly on tennis at that point. Then obviously went into the second lockdown and again tennis courts were shut, so yeah, I ended up cycling a lot more than I was anticipating and just got even more into it and started watching it and like reading about it and just like basically becoming very obsessed with cycling. And then I started working with the coach at the university. Yeah, he's called Phil. And started like actually following a training plan, and then I saw the like application to apply for the Skoda Academy in I think February, and I thought why not give it a go. I wasn't really expecting to get a trial, to be honest, so when I got that through I was just like, oh, it'll be a nice day out in London. I probably won't get much more than that, and I really, really enjoyed the day, just like meeting everyone, like a group of girls who are all really into cycling. It's not something I found a lot of up to that point, so it was nice to speak to those people. And then I got a phone call a week later, like during one of my exams, because we were doing 24-hour online exams, saying that I got into the academy, and I was just like, thank you. I didn't really know what to say. I was really, really overwhelmed. And then I had to try and concentrate on my exam for the next like 10 hours because it was an awful exam. Yeah, so that was a bit hard. But it's been like a whirlwind of a couple of months. But yeah, I'm so excited to be a part of the academy.
What's the kind of biggest thing about cycling that, the biggest thing that you've had to learn about it, or the most kind of confusing thing that when you were first getting into it, you were like, what is this about?
Oh, so much. just like how to set up my bike, so like my position's not completely wrong, like right shoes, right things to wear, like how to enter races, what kind of, how to actually race and not cause a crash. yeah, it's all been very new, but I'm enjoying learning, and like the academy's been really good for that because obviously they have the original members now who are really experienced, and even like Sarah Story and the Story Racing girls that we're linked to obviously have done loads of races and are really, really happy to help and pass on advice. So yeah, I've been learning a lot in the last couple months.
And do you now beat your dad up the hills, I hope?
Yeah. Not that he'll admit it, but yeah.
So that was Maddie Eldon-Gates and Olivia French, who are now part of the Skoda Cycling Academy.
And the other two new recruits are Lucy Elmore and Gwyneth Parry, joining Megan Dickerson, Morgan Newbury, Meredith Gilbert and Rebecca Richards in the Skoda DSI Cycling Academy under the mentorship of Sarah Story. And thanks once again to Skoda for their support of the cycling podcast and the loan of the beautiful gleaming white, well, it was gleaming, it's not so gleaming now, white Skoda Superb that we used at the Tour de France. Is that it for this month, Rose? When's Cryptic Criterium?
Can
you do a really
maybe,
easy one?
I do actually have one in mind.
You've always got one on
Hold
the back
on
burner, haven't
You're
you?
You're going to have to.
You've always got one.
I do.
I know you wake up at night with your little notepad beside the bed, writing down your clues.
Okay. Yeah, I do. Okay, I do have one, Richard. This is an unofficial one.
Just to ensure fairness, Rose, I'm going to just dial up Orla now, okay? So she can take part in this as well, okay? I'm ringing her now.
Yeah, okay? She's keeping... She's funny, she's... She's keeping very, very quiet.
Top of the morning to you. What's a crack?
Oh, God.
Okay, that's Orla on the line. Off you go.
I'm about to be pulled off air. So here's your cryptic criterion. Another way of describing the song Don't Cry For Me, Argentina.
Oh, no. This is going to be embarrassing when I don't get it. Oh, no. Please.
Do you know the song, Richard? Do you know where the song's from?
Evita.
Or where's the song from? And what is another word for a song?
I
You're going to wish you didn't ask for a cryptic criteria.
Do I lose a point if I don't? If I can't get it? If it's a Orla, I mean, Orla's like, very quiet okay, so you on the other end of the line, so she obviously doesn't know it either.
Yeah, she is, isn't she? How unusual!
How unusual.
Like, but you know, if you think about, you know, another way for a word for like a song. What is it? What is this? What are songs and tracks and symphonies? They're all examples of
music,
like pop and rock. Yeah, so put the two words together.
Music Evita.
Evita music.
Oh God, sorry. Oh, sorry. Oh, okay. Covered myself.
I think you don't want to have
there.
This cut out, aren't you?
No, it's fine. It's fine.
Evita music,
the new French,
FDJ
the new French
rider.
Champion, no less.
The new French champ. Yeah.
Oh, that's embarrassing, isn't it?
And probably be cast off of the podcast now, aren't you?
My brain just wasn't processing that properly.
Well, you asked for that. You asked for that, Richard. You know,
I got there in the end, I think, and that puts me 1 point ahead of Orla.
Did you? I don't know that music Evita is the answer, is it? But well, anyway, there'll be more. We'll have. I'll definitely prepare one. I thought that was going to be an easy one. But I'll be preparing another cryptic criterion for the next time that we meet, which will be in August, which is coming up on us very, very quickly. And what we'll have then, we'll have a ladies tour of Norway. That's in August. The San Sebastian, that'll be taking place very, very shortly too. And we'll have Orla back, I hope, by then. Although I'm sure yet again.
I mean, I'm sure she'll come back.
You are, I hope so. Well, no, not that I haven't enjoyed this, Richard, I should say. But, you know, if she's still on the line, Orla, are you there?
No. Oh, she's gone now.
She's
actually gone.
She's
disappointed not to be able to answer that.
Oh, right.
Disappeared.
But there'll be plenty more racing. The Women's World Tour will resume and plenty more to talk about, plenty more of riders to listen to, and we'll be the Three Musketeers yet again. So, Richard, thank you very much for your company.
Looking forward to it. Thank you, Rose. Thank you. Enjoy the rest of your holiday.
And you and anyone else on holiday, enjoy that or enjoy going to work. I don't know. Now I've
and people not on holiday, enjoy yourselves as well.
Yeah. All those. Everyone, have a nice time. Just have a nice time. Have a good summer.
Have a nice time.
Enjoy it.
Yeah.
All right. See you next time.
Bye.